Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the massive release of radioactive fallout spewing from the out-of-control nuclear plants in Japan with Victor Galinsky, who served two terms as commissioner for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and was in charge of the response to the Three Mile Island accident that was almost a nuclear disaster. Then we'll get an update on the military reversals in Libya for the freedom fighters who are being routed by Gaddafi's overwhelming military power while the UN dithers over a no-fly zone. Ambassador David Mack, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, joins us to explain our inaction and the next stage in the conflict. Then finally, we'll talk about the price of oil, which has little to do with problems in Libya and Bahrain, but a lot to do with market speculation, where $40 billion is being betted by speculators that the price of oil will go up. Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, joins us. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Dr. Victor Galinsky, who is an independent consultant on energy matters. He has been deeply involved in nuclear power, nuclear proliferation, and nuclear fuel cycle and waste issues. He served for two terms as commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where he played an important role in tightening U.S. nuclear export standards, and most recently has been a consultant to the state of Nevada in relation to the proposed Yucca Mountain nuclear waste depository. Thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing, Dr. Victor Galinsky.
Hi.
What we know, as much as we know about the ongoing disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi plant in Japan, where four of the six reactors are in, some of them are in what appears to be stages of meltdown, but it looks as if reactor number four that had been shut down for maintenance and the fuel rods had been removed, it looks as though the fuel rods in what is called the swimming pool are now going through criticality, and that seems like a hideous prospect.
It's not criticality, it's overheating. They've lost the water there. And the spent fuel pool has all the used fuel from previous operations. So it has many years worth of spent fuel, and it has, or one way to look at it, is many reactor cores in there. It also has the most, as you pointed out, the most recent core, which is the hottest of all the fuel in any of the spent fuel pools. And it is so hot that if it is not underwater, if it's just in air, it will, first of all, the tubing around it will interact with hot steam to form hydrogen. The tubing will disintegrate, and the fuel itself will melt. And the danger in that is that the melted fuel will vaporize and release radioactive, the dangerous radioactive elements that were formed during the reactor operation process during fission. And there's a direct path to the air. I mean, the building is open. First of all, the building is not very strong anyway, but in any case, a whole wall is just blown open. So there's a direct path from there to the human environment.
And there have already been two fires.
Yeah, they had a fire, and then they thought they put it out, and maybe they did, but anyway, then there was another fire.
So what do you make of these stories, Victor Galinsky, about for example, in reactor two, the core getting exposed because a engine-powered pump ran out of fuel? Would that suggest, obviously on the surface it looks like incompetence, but the explanation may well be that it's very difficult to get manpower in there exposing themselves to the kind of radiation that's there on site?
Well, I don't know that I'd call it incompetence. I mean, basically what happened is you had a situation which went way beyond anything that had been foreseen in approving the safety of the plant, approving the license. And they lost electric power to all the reactors in that group, those three anyway, one, two, three. And you have to have electric power to power the emergency cooling pumps, because when a reactor shuts down, it continues to generate heat at something like initially 6 or 7% of the original, which is still huge. And if you don't get the heat out of there, ultimately the fuel is, in the first instance, damaged. As I said earlier about the spent fuel pool, the tubing reacts with steam to form hydrogen. The hydrogen can burn or explode, but then ultimately the fuel can melt, and again you've got this, you know, the fuel becomes more accessible to certainly if you have a path from there to the environment. If the fuel melts completely or the melt goes a long way, the melted fuel could melt right through the steel pressure vessel and fall into the surrounding concrete containment. It's not designed to hold anything like this. It's unclear what happens. So it's extremely grave. I would judge that that process has gone at least partway in each of the first three reactors. I think they report that they think around, you know, they have it about half full of water instead of being full with water up to the required level. But I think the fuel above that has probably been destroyed, in effect, and it's slumped down. But I don't think we're going to find out. I mean, assuming it doesn't get any worse, and assuming it doesn't actually proceed to the point where the stuff actually gets through the pressure vessel, and there's some hope to think that it won't, I don't think we're going to find out the status of that fuel, what actually happened in those pressure vessels, until years from now when they cool down and we cool down in terms of radioactivity and we open them up, or the Japanese open them up.
That's pretty much what happened after Three Mile Island. I think you were the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Well, I wasn't the head, but I was actually the person in charge on the first day because the chairman was away. But that's right. We didn't find out for years that half the fuel had melted. In other words, even after all the excitement, the assumption was that a very small amount of melting had taken place, if any at all. And it was a shock to discover years later that more than half the fuel had melted. And the reports that were written on the accident a year or year and a half later very much underestimated the extent of the damage. In fact, the report of the Presidential Commission, report of the NRC itself. So there are a lot of unknowns here.
Well, but are you, I mean, a lot of critics have charged that the dangers of nuclear power being downplayed from day one. I mean, is this a pattern here?
Well, I think nuclear power is treated differently than other things in the sense that it's what's called federal preemption of all safety regulation. So whereas other things are decided by people, whether, you know, facility goes in, or, I mean, by people in the sense of locality or the state government, in the case of nuclear power, it's pretty much decided by five commissioners in Washington. And the tendency in the Washington system and in the industry was, let me say, they didn't always have their priorities right about promoting nuclear power versus public safety. I mean, you know, everyone repeats this sort of mantra that, you know, all forms of energy have their risks, which is true. But I think it's very important that the risks be explained clearly and people have a chance to decide whether they want to take the risk or they don't want to take the risk. And that hasn't always been the case in connection with nuclear energy.
Well, we have the recent case of the Yankee plant up in Vermont that the legislature wanted to close, the governor wants to close,
right,
and yet it got relicensed. Now, of course, it got relicensed only a few days before this disaster in Japan, but what do you think explains the ability of the NRC to trump local concerns?
Well, the NRC doesn't pay that much attention to them. Incidentally, that plant is very similar to the units that we're discussing here in Japan. It's the same design. But I don't know to what extent it's been upgraded. Incidentally, there's a point here on that. It's the oldest plants of these 10 that they have in Fukushima 1 and 2 that have gotten into trouble. And they were licensed, as was Vermont Yankee and other plants, to less demanding standards than the current ones. Now, they've been upgraded to some degree since then, but there's generally resistance on the part of the companies to upgrade because it's expensive. And my suspicion is that since it was the oldest plants that got into trouble in Japan, that they were not, in fact, upgraded adequately. And I think the record on that is going to be very interesting in the postmortems. What the state of affairs is at Vermont Yankee, I just don't know.
Wasn't the 1 and 2 at Fukushima Daiichi scheduled to be decommissioned in a few months?
I had heard that that was that Unit 1 was reaching the 40-year mark, and that would be the end of it, but it would be closed down, but I'm not sure.
So Viktor Galinsky, again, a former commissioner with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we're talking about the current situation in Japan as much as we know of it. Interesting, and somewhat, I think, rather sadly, most of the when I'm on the air talking about trying to find out what's happening with this ongoing disaster in Japan, a lot of the listener messages that come on the screen are from people saying, "Will the radiation reach us?"
No, we're thousands and thousands of miles.
I know, but it doesn't sort of deal with the reality of what's happening in Japan.
Right. No, it's extremely grave. Now, I had heard that they think they can get power in there pretty soon, and if they do that, that would certainly be a big plus. What is unclear is whether the equipment that they need to operate is operable, and so that they can get various pumps and valves going and so on. But for that, you have to know the details, and we're just too far away from that.
But one of the things that seemed to come out of this, in terms of, and as you know from being with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, there are these red team kind of exercises to test security at our nuclear plants, and there have been various terrorist scenarios suggesting that if a terrorist were to fire a rocket-propelled grenade at the wall of one of these swimming pools to drain the water, you would have an accident or a disaster comparable to what's happening in Japan today. But this disaster in Japan seems to indicate to me that these plants are actually more vulnerable to nuclear terrorism if you can turn off the backup system as the earthquake and tsunami did in Japan.
Well, I think it may be a bit more difficult than you say, but the basic point is that you have a whole bunch of safety backup systems. They were designed and assumed to be independent, so the likelihood of all of them failing at the same time was very, very small, so it was thought. But if you have an event that couples them all, like a tsunami hitting them all and knocking over their fuel tanks, then those assumptions go out the window, and that's what happened here. I mean, people assumed that all these systems couldn't fail together. And the problem is a more general one. You may have three diesel generators that are in separate rooms and separately supplied and independently operated. On the other hand, so if the chance of one of them failing is 1 in 100, then you multiply 1 in 100 times 1 in 100 times 1 in 100, and the chance of all three of them failing at the same time is 1 in a million. But if the same guy, maintenance guy, comes around and puts the wrong oil into each one of them, then, again, that assumption goes out the window. So you have to be very careful to examine these assumptions that have led to these very low probabilities of accidents. They're all based on these safety systems being independent, and often there are things that couple them, and it's really quite a subtle business.
Well, my understanding, Viktor Galinsky, is that Admiral Rickover, who to some extent pioneered the nuclear power industry in as much as the propulsion reactor for the submarines that he developed was scaled up to be the first nuclear plants, he apparently always felt that Murphy's Law being as it is and the requirement for discipline with nuclear power being so great that only the military should be running nuclear power. Is that something that...
Well, I don't remember that he said the military. Actually, I knew Admiral Rickover, and he seemed to take a fatherly interest in me because I think we both came from Poland at the age of 6 or something. But at different times. But he certainly put safety first. There was no question about that. And incidentally, at one point, he wanted, after he retired, he wanted to be sort of an informal chief inspector for the NRC, which I supported. And the rest of the commissioners were absolutely horrified and rejected the idea.
Given what's involved in controlling nuclear fission, do you think that mankind is up to the task?
Well, I'll tell you, it takes a tremendous sustained effort and discipline to run these plants. We've gotten pretty good at it, but when you talk about expanding it, you really have to ask whether, with all these complications, and there's a whole range of other things that concern me anyway, the fact that technology spreads around the world, you're basically spreading the capability to make weapons or bringing people a lot closer to that capability. And, you know, it's, I don't know. I'm rethinking things myself, let me put it that way.
Well, just in closing then, Viktor Galinsky, one of the guests I had on yesterday said that, made the analogy that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, of which you, on which you served, was similar to the Minerals Management Division of Interior that had oversight over the BP rig in the Gulf, for example. And that was the analogy, is that the oil companies apparently had it either funded or had a
Now, you know, watching those guys, I think the NRC isn't as bad as that.
Does it get its funding from the nuclear industry, or is it independently funded by the taxpayer?
Well, I think it's funded mainly by fees from the industry.
It is funded by
me. But there is a point to what you're saying. I think the agency has been overly accommodating to the industry. And in fact, it was, you know, a little over 10 years ago, it was basically broken by Senator Domenici, Pete Domenici, and this isn't just my observation. He brags about it in his book, how he did this and forced them, you know, to come to heel, and relishes it. It's a, he wrote a book on nuclear power, and you'll find it in there. And the agency kind of turned around. The chairman at that time, Shirley Jackson, fired the top experienced regulators that the industry didn't like, and after that, they were sort of a much more industry-friendly agency.
Well, we'll wait and see whether this event in Japan changes that. I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles.
Take care.
Dr. Viktor Galinsky. Again, Dr. Galinsky is an independent consultant on energy issues. He has been deeply involved in nuclear power, nuclear proliferation, and nuclear fuel cycles and waste issues. He served two terms as commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where he played an important role in tightening U.S. nuclear export standards. And most recently, he has been a consultant to the state of Nevada in relation to the proposed Yucca Mountain Nuclear Waste Repository. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how Libya is turning into a victory for Gaddafi, and then what do we do once that happens?